episode of Caravan to Midnight. I am John B. Wells. It's a pleasure to be with you, and thank you so much for being with us. No one can deny the impact that the Beatles had on the entire civilization, and I mean, I'm talking about the global civilization. It is my pleasure to introduce to you Harvey Kubernick. Who is Harvey Kubernick? Well, I'll tell you. He's a veteran rock journalist. He is 100% L.A. And his new book is, It Was 50 Years Ago Today, The Beatles Invade America and Hollywood. And let me just tell you a little bit about him. He draws on his extensive archive of interviews to produce what's essentially an oral history of reminiscences from musicians and performers inspired by the Fab Four. Davy Jones, Roger McGuinn, Al Cooper, those who work for them, documentarians, Albert Mazelis and D.A. Pennebaker, Beatles producer George Martin and his son Giles, and others who had close encounters with the group. DJ and perennial L.A. scenester Rodney Bingenheimer writes a passage, My Day with George Harrison. Harvey is a Los Angeles native, Southern California resident. He was a featured speaker. This is just recent stuff. He was a featured speaker in 06, discussing audio tape preservation and archiving, a special hearing called by the Library of Congress and held in Hollywood. Now, this coming May, he and Henry Diltz and Gary Strobel will serve as guest curators of the Grammy Museum's year-long Laurel Canyon Music Exhibition that will replace the current Ringo Starr Peace and Love exhibit. And during last month, Harvey's book, It Was 50 Years Ago Today, The Beatles Invade America and Hollywood, was published by Other World Cottage Industries. But there's ever so much more, because he lived it, and he's still living it. And so, I'll tell you what, let's just get this thing rolling. Without any further ado, Harvey Kubernick, what a pleasure to talk to you and have you on the program as we, as we've just sort of...
Delighted to be here.
Well, we're just making it a week-long thing because, you know, there were lots of bands, but nobody did it like the Beatles. Nobody had that effect. It was just monumental. And, you know, they're still selling records. 50 years. I mean, back in those days, I was a child in the 60s, but I don't remember hearing music from the 1910s. But you hear Beatle music everywhere you go. And it's just extraordinary. It was a real phenomenon, and it just hasn't let go of its effect yet.
You know, I wasn't possessed or obsessed doing a book on the Beatles. I have 6 books out and 4 of them in production, except I just happened to be a child of Hollywood who was there when it first happened. And there were so many new items and so much territory and so many voices, and I'll call them witnesses, that I had met along the last 40 years as a music journalist and an author and a record producer. And I always was taking mental notes, not like, when is this thing going to end and I better do a quick book or something. It's just... I thought there was an untold story, and you know, I'm basically a storyteller, and I thought there was really an untold story and a saga about the Beatles that hadn't really been addressed. And when you are confronted with the challenge of doing a book on the Beatles, considering maybe there's, what, 2,200 other books that have come out in the last 50 years, you know, before you, you better deliver and bring something new to the table. And I know I've done that. And the music just resonates. And, you know, I have an advantage over some of the people who write Beatle books or collect the music, because I really know how the music industry works, considering, you know, I once had an executive producer as a A&R man at MCA Records. So I've seen it through the, you know, the executive perch. I've seen it on the street. I've seen it as an interviewer. I've seen it as a DJ. I've seen it as a television host before there was MTV. And I've interviewed, you know, Murray the K and Dick Clark. Not out of desperation. These were people that I encountered along my path. And so I just kind of kept a little bit of an archive percolating, because, you know, I just, the music started to speak to me deeper. The older you get, music gets into your tissue a little deeper. Part of it is the recall aspect of it, but also when we compare it to some of the music that's hurled at us today, I think that McCartney-Lennon songwriting team is better than we ever realize.
You know, there are a bunch of things about that whole creative process that makes me it's indescribable. And people today, I mean, through books like yours and just keeping the not only the memory but the memory of the atmosphere that surrounded this great creativity. Now, Harvey, I got to tell you something. I've got a question that's been dogging me for years, and I mean literally years.
I'm gonna throw it at me.
I was lying on the floor of my parents' den in Fort Worth, Texas, building a model of the Memphis Belle B-17. And I could swear that in October of 63, the Beatles came on the air, and they just came on. I think it was Sullivan's Show. I'm not sure, but I think it was. And when I went to school the next day, I was in the fifth grade. When I went to school the next day, I was like, did you see that band that was on last night? Like Combo is what we called them then. Like nobody knew anything. Well, a few months later, they came on again. And when I went to school the next morning after that show, or the next, I guess, I think Sullivan's Show was a Saturday show. I'm not even sure anymore. But anyway, the next school day, now they had lyrics to their songs written down, songs I hadn't even heard. It's like, wait a minute, they played either Love Me Do or I Want to Hold Your Hand. I think it was I Want to Hold Your Hand. And they had lyrics written out to Can't Buy Me Love and everything else. I'm like, what happened? Did I just step through some sort of a space-time continuum rip in the fabric or what? Because I could swear I saw these guys a few months before and nothing happened. And then they came back and then everything happened. Now, what happened?
I'll tell you exactly what happened, because I had a similar experience in Los Angeles, but let me lay out a few facts. I mean, listen, one of the things that I pride myself in, because I didn't get into this rock and roll racket for the money, I assure you, just like you in radio. We like the economics of it, but it was never the prime concern, was it? But we do like truth, and we like the information, and we bring our passion to it. So let me clear up some situations so you can sleep better at night.
Thank you.
The Beatles had some initial airplay in this country in very late 1962, whether it be a disc jockey, Dave Hull, maybe in Ohio, and then actually maybe the first real Beatles airplay, and I'm talking in America, was very late 62 in Chicago by a disc jockey named Dick Biondi, who is a close pal of Ewart Abner, who is an executive with the VJ record label, who distributed and housed the Beatles' first recordings like in the year of 1963. So there was a little bit of airplay in America, you know, of Love Me Do principally, and Please Please Me, you know, advanced DJ copies, you know, that world of white label 45. There was a little bit of leakage in initial airplay. And then through 63, stations, especially in Texas and in L.A., due to the early form pre-RKO chain radio, some adventurous disc jockeys who liked rockabilly music and liked the music of Motown started playing some of the music of the Beatles on VJ as well. What happened, and I saw this thing, in January, early January of 1964, roughly 5 or 6 weeks before the Beatles made their appearance on Ed Sullivan, Jack Parr had a popular television show.
Yeah.
He played clips of the Beatles doing Love Me Do, and I think For Me to You, they were licensed footage from the BBC, one from the Cavern Club, and maybe their very first video For Me to You or something like that. And listen, that reached 30, 34 million people. Jack Parr had seen the Beatles in 63, I think at their Royal Command, you know, performance. And he had a daughter that was very excited about the Beatles. And he scooped Ed Sullivan and kind of stepped in front of Ed Sullivan, either through a competition thing, sort of like Leno to Letterman kind of deal. And you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And he stepped in front of the long-awaited debut of the Beatles in, you know, February 64. And it really irritated Sullivan. These are things that are in my book. And so you got to hear some Beatle music through Texas, Dallas, Fort Worth, on the AM dial, just one-and-done kind of spins by, you know, DJs. And then you saw the Ed Sullivan show, and you might have glimpsed the Jack Parr show. But what happened when I saw the Beatles on Jack Parr... And I had seen rock and roll already, including the Beach Boys out here in late 1962 in Culver City. I was completely flipped out, maybe a little bit by the hair and the wardrobe and all that, but the sound was so rockin'. I went to school that day, and everybody thought I was nuts, and people were throwing spitballs at me. You know, like nobody was digging what I saw. Then 6 weeks later, when they were on Ed Sullivan... The next week, I could have run for student body president of that place.
I'll bet.
You know about that turnover because you saw it happen to you.
Absolutely.
And then there was a marketing blitz of $40,000 or $50,000 committed by Capitol Records and T-shirts and mugs and lunch boxes and then their closed circuit television concert ran, you know, in around mid-February. And so February of 64, the invasion really exploded, and that's why you were able to hear Love Me Do or Please Please Me or I Want to Hold Your Hand, and people were, like, writing lyrics on their peachy folders. You know what I'm talking about. The whole thing just engulfed everybody.
I'm telling you, the classroom was just incandescent, and the teacher wasn't doing anything about it. I mean, these people were exchanging lyrics. I mean, some of them had, like, you know, 4 and 5 sheets of complete lyrics. And I'm like, where did you guys get this stuff? I haven't even heard these songs.
Well, listen, we were all hungry. I mean, we were all hungry for something.
Yep.
But as we're older now and we look back at that period, and we have an advantage over some of your listeners, and it's not to brag and it's not to do a one-upsmanship. We were there. There's an advantage of being there than today's revisionist history by bloggers and rookies and people born after 1959, and I'm not putting anybody down due to their age, but we are on the Mayflower regarding this Beatles voyage to America.
That's right.
And I'm very proud of that, and I parade my age and I parade my experience, and I think that's one of the strengths of my book or the conversation we're having today, because the conversation you and I are having today is probably a little different than the most recent activities that have celebrated the Beatles' 50-year love affair with America. The people that were in the classroom, me in Culver City or Beverly Hills or Los Angeles and you in Fort Worth, Texas or whatever, we were in the same classroom. We didn't know it.
Isn't that amazing? So I did see them, and everybody thought I was crazy. I'm like,
no. They thought you were Meshuggah, and it's plagued you for a half a century.
Yes.
And I've just given you the answer without going to the shrink.